oh my god, I've achieved such great things, I'm flexible and now I can flex this, but then you drop it for 1 week and then you try coming back to doing the same thing and you're back to square one. You have to keep that consistent practice without the ego coming in way. Practice is infinite. You are tuned into episode 3 of Mind the Gap, a podcast where we bridge diverse perspectives, one conversation at a time. Welcome to Mind the Gap, a podcast where every fortnight we explore the topics of self-leadership and neuroscience in service of holistic well-being. I'm Harmeet Anand, with extensive experience coaching leaders across global organizations. I use the ontological approach, somatic principles, and mindfulness practices to support the leaders and teams I coach.
And I'm Sana Anand, with a background in heart science and a budding neuroscientist. We'd like to preface that we are not experts in these realms,
and we invite you to join us in our podcast where we document our conversations, offering distinct generational and professional points of view. Stay tuned. Last time when we met, we spoke about intentions and also how to make powerful intentions, especially the ones which are in alignment with who we are, who we want to become, and our purpose. And we also spoke about how intentions help us reflect on, let's say, ended a task or ended a day. Intentions and actions help us reflect on each other, whether they have been in alignment as well or not.
Yeah, and that benefit of intentions only comes if we set them regularly and ritualistically daily. But that element of ritualisticness doesn't just come in intentions, but also in our practices. And I don't mean practices to pursue actions towards our goal, but I mean the practices that surround the actions that we take to pursue our goals. And by this, I mean rituals that just set us in our mood to do that, enact that behavior. So that would mean environments, people, mindsets, and behaviors that play a supporting but still important role to that pursuer. If I think about this in terms of daily life or maybe a scenario that somebody would encounter, I think of if a writer was trying to write a new novel but was facing writer's block, the best way I would say for them to be able to get out of it is if they think about how do they feel when they're writing that book. Where are they writing this book? Are they writing it in a coffee shop with many people there, or are they writing it in a quiet place? In the morning or in the night, burning the midnight oil? Have they drank coffee or wine or something to get them to write? Do they have a backstory? How are they setting a tone in their mind? And that really requires reflection. And those practices support our goals.
Something that you spoke about today, Sana, which was around the environments and not necessarily related to the action, but the environment. I want to go a little further into it. I think the environment is a way of helping that individual who's taking an action eventually be the best of who they are or not be the best of who they are. So I believe that practices that help an individual or help a team be the best of who they are things that we often kind of ignore and don't do it. And today we want to really talk about that.
Yeah, and identifying those practices requires you to be really objective about it. So I feel like you have to externalize it from yourself, almost characterize yourself and look at those traits, values, or behaviors that you're undertaking. And don't judge yourself for them. Because you're externalizing it, consider a character. Like, characters do have their flaws, but we don't judge them for it. We know that that is their goal. And we understand that there's a value behind those rituals. So that's what makes us not be lax with those things. So for me, I know that to study for a test, I need to do certain things a certain way. I have a procedure to do things. I will study it. I'll write it out. I'll type it. I'll talk to people about it. I'll teach people. And I know that that is what will lead me to an action result. And that those are my practices.
Wonderful. I like what you mentioned. And I think that also sets a distinction of the different types of practices we are talking about. What you spoke about is like a dress rehearsal of the final event or an action we're going to take. For example, when I'm doing facilitation or work which is around groups, then my practices also become alive maybe a few days earlier, where I'm writing it down, where I'm recording it, I'm listening, and if possible, even taking feedback from the right people to know how it went. So just to summarize, practices can be of two kinds. One is a dress rehearsal and the other one that helps us be the best version of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you talked about this externalizing of the character and then looking at it at very objectively and then working through it, I think that's brilliant. I'm going to take that, leaf from your notebook to do that for me as well. But I have a question for you,
yeah.
Especially around practices which become like rituals, things that we do every day. I know who I am. I'm a person who likes to do new things. And there's a kind of a boredom that sets in into doing rituals.
You know, I understand that, especially when you reach that plateau. That's when you have to know to push forward and experience and live through that pain. The novelty is only brought in when you immerse yourself and don't numb yourself to the sensorial feelings that you're feeling in that moment. You don't avoid being committing to that moment. You're not trying to believe that you have this ego and you know what you're doing with these actions. Instead, you take the example of working out, for instance. If I've been repeatedly doing these exercises, I get bored and completely sick of going to the gym. But that's when I introduce a new element to focus on, like, am I hinging correctly? Should I change the weight? Should I use this machine or that machine? And that allows me to introduce an element of novelty where maybe the stimulus is not changing, but the value that I've set is what is changing. And that leads to a positive prediction error. So there'd be more dopamine activation.
Well, let me come back to that phrase that you mentioned, the positive prediction error.
Yeah.
But when you were talking about the gym, you know, I can completely relate to it. When I was really pushing myself to somehow run without music, because I thought, like, let me change my running routine by changing how I run. And I experienced the same aspect that you were talking about, like immersing in the moment, allowing me to make my runs very interesting every day. Like, it was a completely new experience instead of running to the same playlist or, you know, the songs that are there on my playlist. Like, I remember putting a few minutes to just focus on what I'm seeing on the pathway, or a few minutes to just listen to the sounds that are happening around me. And then that kind of changed that experience around what was happening with me. And I started thinking, it's like a new run every day. But coming back to that positive prediction error, that's what you said. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so just to provide some context for our listeners here, I'm talking about dopamine activation. So say you've been stimulated by some sort of cue, your dopamine gets rises, and then after you receive a reward, you receive a certain amount of dopamine stimulation as well. But let's say you are consistently getting that stimulus.
Mm.
Your positive prediction error goes down because you're less and less surprised by that stimulus. So if you change some element of that stimulus, you're more likely to expect a certain amount of reward, but you would gain more reward. And that is a positive prediction error here. And here I'm saying not change the stimulus, but change the value that we place on that stimulus. So in the working out example, you're not changing your behavior, but you're just changing what you're focusing on, which changes the value of the stimulus, and hence you get a greater prediction error.
Now I get it. And in all of this, I'm also sensing, you know, just to keep doing different practices or same practices, but experiencing them in a novel way, still requires a fair bit of the virtue of patience, isn't it?
Really, either we have patience or prepare to be humble. Like, if I think about this in terms of yoga, if I have got a particular skill, I feel like, oh my God, I've achieved such great things. I'm flexible and now I can flex this. But then you drop it for 1 week and then you try coming back to doing the same thing and you're back to square one. You have to keep that consistent practice without the ego coming in way. Practice is infinite, is what I've learned.
Oh, nice. Practice is infinite. You know, this whole idea of having continuous practice.
Well, I wanted to poke at that as well. I understand how and what we do when we drop practices and when we're procrastinating. Like, that's when our automatic processes where we feel like we want something now, that overpowers our prefrontal cortex's rationalism and thinking about a long-term reward. And so what feels good now overweighs that long-term reward and we end up procrastinating. So it's been found that college students report less stress in the moment when they're procrastinating, but then actually they end up getting lower grades and higher stress in the moments when they actually have to give those tests, despite saying that procrastination, it is what pushes them to
do their work last minute, they don't end up getting the results that they want. But I'm wondering about the why. Why do we drop that practice? Why do we procrastinate, especially when we can create new feelings for those same experiences?
That's a good question. I think on the topic of procrastination, why do we put hard things for later? A very common way of looking at it is that change itself is hard. For example, if I want to lose weight, and I know for that I have to be somebody who's consistently going to the gym or running, but I have a self-belief around the fact that I am not a person who is, let's say, a gym goer, or I'm not a person who is health conscious. So it all comes down to who we think we are right now, our own self-beliefs, and then who we want ourselves to be. And all of this can lead to procrastination.
That's also because there's an expectation of perfectionism in the element that you were saying over there. That person believes that everybody that has reached the top of the mountain suddenly appeared at the top of the mountain. They didn't have to climb to get there. And that's why we think that perfectionism is the only way that we can receive that high award.
You know, that external perfectionism is something that has already been put into our social psyche.
Projected
by media, in terms of everything has to be perfect. And something I'm finding it, very common with the Gen Z, that they wouldn't do something unless it is absolutely.
But I think perfect. There's a difference, you know, like I also consider myself a perfectionist in some regard, but I don't think of it as completely negative. I would say there are two categories of perfectionism. There's self-determined perfectionism as well as socially prescribed or externally imposed perfectionism. And that's when there is a correlation between that external pressure and procrastination. And so we're anxious to avoid judgment, and that's what leads to that anxious procrastination. But with self-determined perfectionism, we know those standards that we've set ourselves again. And so it's in our control and we can meet those standards. The unknown with external pressures versus the known of self-determined pressures is, I guess, what weighs out perfectionism in my eyes.
Yeah, and it's interesting you speak about, you know, you being a perfectionist and having that internal standards for yourself. But somehow I've observed that people who are having very high standards of themselves, or who call themselves as perfectionists, can also end up procrastinating much more, essentially because there is a fear of making mistakes.
How do you think, though, that those mistakes are important in practice, and how do we really grow to learn to embracing that?
Practices per se are done, especially the dress rehearsal kind of practices, so that we can make all the mistakes there than when we have to really take action, right? So the need to have those kind of practices is so that we can learn from the mistakes over there.
Yeah, the more I think about it, I'm realizing, like, how do babies learn? Like, they make mistakes. How they get reprimanded, learn through punishment and reward. And how do machines learn? By making errors. It's the same basic principle applied everywhere.
Yeah. And on that, you know, on that point of making mistakes and being reprimanded, I think that's where we kind of, as when we become an adult, we feel as if making mistake is something wrong, and we will be criticized for it and be critical for it. And that keeps a lot of people from continuing to learn or be a learner on their path. And they start thinking of themselves as experts and stop practicing.
Yeah, and that's also what a perspective is required when you're thinking about whether a mistake is actually a negative outcome or not. A lot of achievement motivated people actually pursue without procrastination. And if I think about the neuroimaging behind that, it actually supports this idea of mistakes being important for learning as well as motivation. Because neuroimaging has shown that there's greater activation in areas like the left precuneus that are important for value evaluation and self-reflection. And that is where we can weigh costs as well as long-term positive values. And there's also activation in areas of the prefrontal cortex, which, as I mentioned before, is responsible for cognitive control. And so we can exert that control on those negative outcomes. Therefore, there will be less weight placed on those mistakes, as well as pressures. So we can see that long-term gain. There is no emotional value per se placed on that negative outcome, you know?
Sorry, did you say these words for people who are achievement-oriented?
Achievement oriented, yes. Yeah, that's so they are able to somehow put less value on the emotions around the mistakes that they are making.
And maybe put them in perspective of positive outcomes.
Yeah, a long-term view of what they are doing. Absolutely. So making mistakes is part of the growing process, especially for people who are also achievement-oriented. There's nothing wrong actually in making mistakes. In fact, I would say, go on to say that mistakes are the soil of growth and learning. And instead of feeling as if we've done something wrong from mistakes and failures, we can actually figure out that we are growing and we are learning and we're doing something with our lives.
It's the biggest signpost, actually. And that also makes me think of, how do we know that we have made a mistake? I think the biggest indicator is feedback, you know, and it might feel bad in the present, but in the larger frame of things, it's truly a gift.
Yeah, or we can just enter into assuming that feedback is a gift instead of looking at it as if it is bad. Also, having the right mentors and right people to give feedback is really important.
See,
because
important, yeah.
When you are in an environment where people are supportive of you, you will be able to receive that feedback without feeling bad about it.
And recognizing you're not a mind reader, you're not going to know what people are going to say before they actually say it, especially if they're a mentor or somebody that knows more than you, then listen to them before you go on.
It's, in Buddhism, especially in a lot of Eastern practices, there's a very strong requirement to be part of a sangha or a group.
Mm.
And imagine you're like practicing to be a meditator, but you are still expected to be in a group. And I think the reason is, even though it's a very isolating, solitary sort of a thing that you're doing, is the whole reason of having an environment from which maybe they talk to you or not, but it's pretty visible who you want to be. You know, you have your role models to see over there.
Exactly. You can see people that you look up to in that circle. Like for me in academia, a lot of the mentors and teachers that I look up to, I respect for their level of instruction and quality as well as their humility. And in the industrial world, with all of those domains out there, it ends up feeding our ego. So it's been seen that upon graduating, a lot of people end up entering the industry with a complete overestimation of their competence in their domains. And that's what makes them perhaps more close-minded to learning. That's when I start to think that maybe the road to mastery is actually a beginner's mindset.
Oh, the beginner's mindset is amazing. Most of the martial artists who have the black belts on, actually, because of the grading that they've done or the levels that they've reached, they still prefer to have their white belt on because it keeps reminding them that no matter where you are, having a beginner's mindset is extremely essential. Going back to foundations, like yesterday when we were seeing that episode on Grey's Anatomy, the surgeon still did not...
Both the mentor and the mentee did not know how to do an removal of the appendix.
Yeah. Right, so going back to the foundation and basics, no matter what level you are, so critical. So now I want to ask you, if you had one suggestion, given that you are so good with your practices around well-being, if you have one suggestion to make for our listeners, what would you say around practices?
I'd say just surrender to lifelong learning, and the basics are not beneath you. What about you?
I would say that remember that life will throw curveballs at you.
Mm-hmm. Priorities change.
Priorities change. Consistency matters, yes. But when things go off the course, as you had imagined, then do not live in shame and blame. Especially the emotions around not being consistent on practices can be a deterrent from continuing to be in a group or continuing a good practice that you've had.
What would you say is the difference between shame and blame and guilt?
So, yeah, I think so. For example, guilt is a standard that you've set for yourself and you've not been able to meet. Let's say you want to not eat a cookie or because you're losing weight, and then you go into the kitchen and no one's watching and you take that cookie.
I love that you've been harping on this example.
Yeah, so you basically, maybe I've been doing that a lot. So you feel guilt, right?
Yeah.
Shame is the same assessment that you have around you're not meeting standards, but you also assess that you're not meeting standards that are being set by the tribe that you value in that particular situation.
Yeah.
So for example, if we had told someone that we are creating this podcast.
Yeah.
And we did not end up doing it. Which emotion do you think we'll feel? Guilt or shame?
It's more shame because we've told other people about it. But had we not told people and still not lived up to that goal that we had, that would be more guilt.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. In that sense, I think both are constructs. Like, shame is a construct, but that can be dismantled by communication, because that judgment or idea or prediction of judgment is also in our head. And guilt is also a construct that is dismantled by changing your perspective and what is considered positive or negative in that way.
Absolutely. And especially if you think of the whole conversation we've had around mistakes, then having that also part of the standards that we've set for ourselves can make sure that we do not increase the guilt that we have when we fall off. And because we can always come back on track, right? So we don't just wallow and go down the rabbit hole feeling guilty about things.
I think that's just summarize things.
Yeah,
our listeners now.
Let's do that.
What would you say is a point that our listeners should take away from today's episode?
I think we traversed a lot of places. The idea of having a long-term view when we have practices, we have something consistently happening and we have a practice. Having that long-term view allows us to also not have those negative emotions for a long time.
Yeah, and having mentors that encourage us and are also committed to our learning and our outcomes. And I don't mean having the perfect mentors, because that literally disproves whatever we've been talking about. But I mean just having good mentors, having that have their own practice and also care about
it. Also, I think remembering that keeping the white belt on no matter where you are allows you to have practices at any stage in life.
Yeah, and the phenomena I mentioned in terms of working out and focusing on new elements, that repeating without repeating is really important, especially when you're achieving a plateau or are bored.
Thank you so much, Anna. It was fantastic to have this conversation with you.
It really was. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Mind the Gap. You can subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to this. We hope you learned something from our different perspectives, and if you did, let us know your takeaways on our social media Instagram handle at mindthegap.show.
You can access the show notes of this episode on coachformax.com. That's coach4max.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you feel motivated to engage in conversations that bridge diverse perspectives and create greater mutual understanding.